hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. You're listening to the McCullough Report. This is Dr. Peter McCullough. And in this week's issue of the McCullough Report, I want to do a deep dive into all the social and cultural changes that are happening rapidly in America and across the world related to COVID-19 and now the COVID-19 mass vaccination program. Well, let's jump right into it. We are in a situation now in the world where COVID-19 has been around and very active in almost every country in the world. It's considered endemic at this point in time. It's no longer an outbreak or an epidemic. It is a endemic, meaning that it's in our population. And if you visit worldometer.com, that's one of the best sources for tracking the infection across the globe, you can look at each country and look at the case count. Now, almost all the countries have various databases or executive orders that record positive test results. Now, they don't take into consideration where the test results are established, in the hospital or in the community, and they don't take into consideration if it's in an acutely sick patient who has COVID-19 or if, in fact, it's a false positive patient. So, if an individual is asymptomatic and they have no signs or symptoms of COVID-19 and they generate a positive test, the overwhelming likelihood is that it's a false positive test. Well, all those positive tests are compiled into a case curve, so you have to take that into consideration. But at face value, if you look at the case curves of different counts today in worldometer.com, you'll see very, very different patterns. One of the most disturbing patterns now is in the country of India. India, for the longest time, seemed to do fairly well with the pandemic. It had a varied response with respect to underlying predisposition. There was varying degrees of lockdowns. Many Indians have received what's called the BCG vaccine. That's a vaccine against tuberculosis, but it appears to have some effect on reducing the rates of COVID-19. India had various responses with respect to early treatment. Remember, early treatment doesn't stop COVID-19, but it does reduce the risks of hospitalization and death. And early treatment occurs with a bundle of nutraceuticals and then oral drugs directed against replication of the virus, a cytokine storm or inflammation, and against thrombosis or blood clotting, which is the fatal part of COVID-19. But suffice it to say, what we're witnessing in India now, one of the world's most populous countries, is an epidemic curve or a case count curve that is heading absolutely straight upwards. Now, I've personally visited India before in multiple cities. It's a densely populated country. There's very little space between individuals. And even the most extreme lockdown, in my view, would be hopeless in terms of reducing the spread of infection. Now that it's really taking off, we are going to see rates of disease that I think will be untold in terms of degree of suffering, hospitalization, and death. I'm going to predict that India will take the world stage as a human calamity over the next few weeks or months to come. So we have COVID-19 raging out of control in India. In other countries, taking a very different approach. Sweden had a big bulge of COVID-19, but it's come down, but certainly hasn't gone to zero and now is at a steady case rate per day. The United States, we've had three waves. We had an initial wave in March, which looking back on it in 2020 was pretty mild. We came to a nadir, but not zero cases, had a next wave in the summer of 2020, came down for a very short period of time, a very short valley, if you will, in September. And then we had a big push with COVID-19 through November and December. And then at the end of December, the curve started falling off very quickly. And that was before there was any vaccination. And we believe in the United States, what happened is that early treatment took effect. And we had the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, which came out with a home treatment guide in the third quarter of 2020. We had more data coming in with respect to the use of the drugs. There was a network that AAPS established through telemedicine and through local practitioners, and almost every state had early treatment centers or physicians, and many patients received early treatment. Keep in mind that if a patient develops COVID-19 and they're high risk, age over 50 with medical problems, and they receive medical treatment at home, they're able to serve out the entire quarantine period at home without spreading the virus to others. They shorten the duration of symptoms and reduce hospitalization and death by about 85%. So early treatment clearly is a winner. And it reduces new cases, hospitalizations, and death. And it's the only thing that explains the dramatic fall off in our curves. Now, vaccination started to kick in. I believe the first week in January was the first time any individual in the United States could have been fully vaccinated. And then from that point forward, more vaccinated individuals could have contributed to a stabilized curve. Our curve right now is about 45,000 to 60,000 new cases a day. But the hospitalization rates, the best that we can tell, are staying down and very manageable. And mortality now is below 1,000 cases a day, hopefully below 500 per day from that point forward. So the epidemic curves are very different. They're influenced by spread of the virus, pockets of susceptibility, the use of early treatment, and hopefully the advent of vaccination. But vaccination itself has really created quite a degree of excitement, but also consternation in the United States and across the world. In the United States, we had the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. These were brand new messenger RNA vaccines that had never been utilized or tested before for other vaccination programs, brand new technology. That came on the scene in December of 2020 through the emergency use authorization, which made them available to the public on a voluntary basis, but did not indicate that they were approved or had the judgment of the FDA with respect to efficacy or safety. Then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine became available in March of 2020 and was on the market and being utilized. And then after several rare cases of blood clots developing in the brain in what's called the cavernous venous thrombosis, there was a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine program, and the safety data are being reevaluated. In fact, this week, the U.S. FDA and CDC are set to opine on whether or not the Johnson & Johnson vaccine can be released back into the market for utilization. I can tell you many physicians believe the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was the safest of all the vaccines. It was a one injection platform. It used an adeno-associated viral platform, which is a DNA inactivated virus that carried the code for the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, so very different than messenger RNA. And it was similar to the AstraZeneca vaccine, but that also was withdrawn from about 18 European markets, again, because of this rare blood clotting issue. So the blood clotting issue has been evaluated now in the medical literature, and even up to nearly 20 years ago, adeno-associated viral vectors themselves had a relationship to thrombosis or the development of blood clots. And then we know COVID-19, in fact, that's the mechanism of COVID-19 causing death, is thrombosis or blood clotting. In fact, anticoagulants are essential in treating serious cases of COVID-19. All the vaccines cause the human body itself to produce the spike protein, or the little spiky structures that you see on the cartoon of the COVID-19 virus. And the spike protein pins platelets and red blood cells, causing the blood clotting issue. In fact, there is a problem called vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura, VITT, that's related to the spike protein. And there was a report out of Oxford University that while there was attention on J&J and the AstraZeneca vaccine for market withdrawals due to blood clotting. In fact, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines had 30-fold the blood clotting risk, but in a different area in the portal vein, which drains the liver in the abdomen, also very serious, can be related to liver failure, hospitalization, and death. So all the vaccines from my review are related to blood clotting problems, which are serious. It's just that the Pfizer and Moderna, it's in a different area of the body compared to AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. All the vaccines have been associated with death. Now, the death occurs in three basic scenarios. One is immediate death in the vaccination center by a immediate allergic reaction called anaphylaxis. That's the reason why the government mandates that we have resuscitation equipment in the vaccine centers. The second mode of death appears to be what I call reactogenic. That is, the vaccine is given, and then within about 3 days, the patient dies of what looks like COVID-19. Now, it's not the COVID-19 illness, but in fact, it's all the signs and symptoms of COVID-19 due to generation of the spike protein and probably excessive vaccination-induced production of the spike protein is what kills some frail patients. We see fever, chills, difficulty breathing, nausea, vomiting, and death in that mode. And then the third form of death occurs about 2 weeks later, and it does relate to these blood clots, which take a while to form. And the J&J form of a blood clot called cavernous venous thrombosis, and then the AstraZeneca blood clots, they were also seen in Canada and elsewhere, all appeared about 1 to 3 weeks after vaccination. Now, I want to read to you the update on the vaccine adverse event reporting system, which is provided to you by the US FDA. I encourage you to write down this website. It's called openvaers.com, all together, openvaers.com. This is your window to seeing real-time safety information for the COVID-19 vaccine. It's not produced for you in the major media. It's not produced on any CDC report. Nor is it provided for you at the vaccination center. In fact, the consent form for the vaccine indicates that both the efficacy or the benefit of the emergency use authorized vaccine as well as the safety is unknown. They fairly tell you that when you sign the consent, and you do this under completely voluntary conditions when you go and volunteer for the COVID-19 vaccine. But here's the safety report through April 9th, 2021. And at this juncture, we have had an updated number of 26% of all Americans have been fully vaccinated. And that means 86 million individuals in the United States fully vaccinated, thought to be fully immune, if you will. States range in terms of percent vaccination. The highest in this is in the state of Maine at 33% fully vaccinated. And at the lowest, it's Alabama at 19.7% fully vaccinated. So here are the safety numbers given those denominators. 2602 deaths, 2,602 deaths, 5,074 hospitalizations, 10,078 urgent care visits, 10,693 office visits, 458 cases of anaphylaxis or near-fatal allergic reactions, 481 cases of Bell's palsy or paralyzed face on one side, 559 heart attacks, 100 miscarriages in pregnant women, severe allergic reactions in 3701, and low platelet counts recorded in 338. Keep in mind, to get up on this scoreboard, a healthcare professional has to report this and has to be sufficiently concerned about vaccination-related injury to make this report into the CDC website. So that's the safety scoreboard. By all measures, the COVID-19 is far and away the most deadly and dangerous vaccine that we've ever had unleashed on Americans. In the 1976 swine flu pandemic, 55 million individuals vaccinated. That program was shut down after 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome paralysis and 25 deaths. The U.S. annual influenza vaccine campaign 195 million Americans vaccinated, about 20 to 30 deaths reported to the database. So COVID-19, tremendous safety concerns, and the McCullough report may be one of your only fair windows to getting this data, but do go to openvaers.com and keep updated on it, because it's your life. You decide to make this trip to the vaccination center and you electively undergo vaccination, or conversely, you elect to defer on the vaccine because it's a completely voluntary program. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. You're listening to the McCullough Report, and we're going to pick back up on vaccines. I've just read to you the safety data, the recent developments, and where we are in terms of Americans being vaccinated. But our strategy in the United States largely has been a watch and wait, hunker down, go into lockdown, and simply be saved by the vaccine. That has clearly been the plan of operation from our government agencies, closely tied to cooperation with the media. That means no information on early treatment, no discussion of COVID-19 even being a treatable illness, and simply an absolute all-out push for mass vaccination. We call them vaccine stakeholders. That means entities that have a stake in vaccination. That would be the U.S. FDA, the Center for Disease Control, the U.S. FDA, the National Institutes of Health, which through Operation Warp Speed funded vaccine research to a huge degree, as well as owning intellectual property stakes in at least one of the vaccines. The Moderna vaccine is partially co-owned in terms of its patent by the National Institutes of Health. The executive branch of government, the overall federal government, is highly invested in mass vaccination, as many governments are across the world. Now, vaccination has quickly been assumed to be highly effective and safe. In fact, that message of being effective and safe is promoted to the U.S. public every day. And there's no window to safety information or what's called fair balance for several reasons. One, the vaccines are not fully FDA approved. And so because of that, under emergency use authorization, there's nothing in emergency use authorization that indicates that patients have to get a fair balance of what they're getting into in terms of safety and efficacy. Once the vaccines are FDA approved, and I think they will be fully FDA approved, and I personally will welcome that, the FDA under its current rules of operation must give the public updates on safety and efficacy. And a lot of the data that I've read out to you is going to have to go into a patient safety information in the investigational brochure, as well as the product label for the vaccines. Full FDA approval also means that the vaccines can be advertised by the manufacturers, and then they can be put on the market for sale. Currently, they're pre-purchased by the government and simply provided to you free of charge. So full FDA approval, in my view, will be welcome. It'll give us an opportunity, at least for the agencies, to have their feet held to the fire in giving the public fair information on safety, what we call fair balance. If you ever see a medical product advertised on TV, if it has side effects or risks, they must give a disclosure on TV. As a typical practice, if a drug is released on the market and there are 5 cases of unexplained death, that would give a black box warning, say drug may cause death or may be associated with death. Even if there is not clear-cut causality determined, it's still listed in the black box warning. And then at 50 deaths, typically a drug is removed from the market. Remember, I mentioned at 25, the swine flu was pulled, the whole program was pulled. At 2602 deaths and going, you can see at this point in time, our government has made a commitment. We are going for broke with this vaccine, no matter how many patients die with the vaccine. I think we should all be very disturbed about this type of approach. And it is weighing out the population risks and benefits. COVID-19 certainly can be a fatal illness if it's untreated. We've had 575,000 individuals who have died largely in the hospital. Almost all of them received no early home treatment. That's been our method of approaching it. Certainly not my method as a doctor. I've treated all my high-risk patients and have not had such outcomes, but the U.S. government and the overall health system has taken that approach. It's been calamitous. It's been a total disaster from a mortality perspective, and now the vaccine is piling on with its own vaccine associated deaths, which are temporally related in the first 3 days with these general patterns, and then the thrombosis deaths would occur 1 to 3 weeks later. Now, at 1,600 deaths, the CDC announced that a review of the deaths was performed by CDC and FDA doctors who were unnamed. The methods of the review were not disclosed, nor the ascertainment process for causality, but they indicated incredulously that none of the deaths were related to the vaccine at approximately 1,600 deaths. I can tell you there's not a single reasonable doctor in the United States that believes that, nor is there a single U.S. citizen that believes that. In fact, there are patients who are died directly at the vaccine centers despite attempts at resuscitation, and some of these have been recorded on video. So I don't think there's a single American that believes that the vaccine doesn't cause death. So when you think about or considering electively undergoing vaccination, you do have to consider the risks of death. Even though they've been described as being rare, it's true vaccine-associated deaths and these other complications are rare. It's also true that getting COVID after the vaccine is very rare. In the clinical trials, less than 1% of patients contracted COVID, whether they got the vaccine or placebo. So everything that's related to your choice of vaccination is rare. The efficacy or relative benefit is less than 1% in terms of whether you get it, the vaccine or not, and get COVID or not. And the chances of a side effect are rare, a serious side effect are rare. And so this difficulty that we're asking Americans to grapple with respect to everything being less than 1% with COVID-19 vaccination decisions is making things, in my view, quite difficult. Now, let's move on to this issue of whether or not the vaccine could be potentially monetized, operationalized, or even weaponized as a totalitarian weapon. We've seen great fear over the last year, and all kinds of measures be, in a sense, weaponized. So we've seen closures of the schools, as an example, some schools, despite no outbreaks within schools of COVID-19, no direct evidence of any significant student-to-faculty spread or vice versa. And this reaction has been varied. So some public schools in some states closed down, others didn't. In Dallas-Fort Worth, we had public schools closed down, but the parochial schools stayed open. It didn't seem to make a difference. We've seen some universities close down or go by virtual learning. Others hold in-person classes. Didn't seem to make a difference. We've seen variations with respect to use of masks and lockdown. So I know Texas pretty well. Texas is up there in the top three states in terms of total cases. But I can tell you, Texas is 24 in the United States for number of cases per million population and 24 for the number of deaths per million population. Texas never shut down its economy completely. Our restaurants were always open. Our places of business were open. Our government offices were shut down for a period of time. And we did take some defensive measures. Oddly enough, the most severe things that we did in Texas occurred in March of 2020 when there were so many unknowns and the case count at that time was quite small. And I remember the hospital parking lots being pretty empty while we were shutting down our clinics and trying to do telemedicine. And then at a certain point in time, we basically just gave up on these things and said, listen, we've got to take care of patients. And so during the height of our epidemic curve in November and December, we were seeing patients full-time in our clinics. So none of it really seemed to make sense. And many of us think that these measures may not have made a difference at all. The virus seems to be moving across the globe and across our country according to its own will. Our current blend of viral mutants or variant strains right now, reported by the CDC up to the end of March, is 14. We have 14 circulating strains. We have very little of the original Wuhan wild type strain. Of interest, all the vaccines are coded to the Wuhan wild-type spike protein only. The vaccine gives a relatively limited immunity just to the spike protein, but it's all coded to the wild-type mutant Wuhan strain. And now we have 14 different strains of which we're hoping the vaccine will provide defense against it. The most common vaccine in the United States is the B117 vaccine. The B117 variant, I'm sorry, not vaccine. And the B117 variant is the most common. That's the United Kingdom variant. It's more contagious, but thought to be less fatal. So the vaccines are out there. They're rolling. They're coded against the original spike protein. We're hoping that they will cover the new 14 blend variant that we have in the United States. We've always had a half a dozen or more variants, and that we can get some protection from the vaccine. It's a huge effort. And if we don't see gains on the vaccine, I think we're all going to be enormously disappointed.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Well, we're back from our break. Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report, and we've been discussing vaccines. I've been trying to keep you updated on really the bevy of information that's flowing forward on this. Now, we've discussed where we are with respect to the program, and in the last month, there has been a flow of reports on what's called breakthrough infections or vaccine failures. That is, a fully vaccinated person who should be immune coming down with COVID-19. Those reports have come in allotments of several hundred from Idaho, from Louisiana, Washington State, Michigan, really all over the country. And the headlines are typically some form of surprise. It'll be some human interest story where someone said, listen, I'm fully vaccinated. I thought I was good, and I came down with COVID-19. Now, the CDC did report to the popular media, which did fairly report this out, that towards the end of March, we had 5,800 breakthrough cases in the United States, 7% of which required hospitalization, and the mortality rate was concordant with what we had seen with the de novo infection. My interpretation of this is I think the COVID-19 vaccine failure disease looks like it's the same as regular overall COVID-19. I was hopeful that it was going to be a mild form of disease, that the vaccine would take a bit of starch off of the virus, if you will, and allow individuals to have a more mild case of illness. But we should be conservative and take at face value right now that when a breakthrough infection occurs, one should seek prompt testing. And if they are diagnosed with COVID-19, high risk, age over 50, medical problems, follow the Association of American Physicians guide and get early treatment, because your case of COVID-19 should be no different than if you didn't get the vaccine. But let's hope the rates of these breakthrough infections do not blossom. Right now, we are getting signals that, in fact, they are blossoming in the United States. There was a report from the UK that, based on modeling, since they've had so many patients vaccinated in the UK, that 60 to 70% of anticipated COVID-19 cases in 2021 will occur in fully vaccinated individuals. So here we go again. Vaccine, no vaccine, COVID-19 cases will arise. Let's turn our attention to the second half of the show on the whole issue of civil liberties, this emerging totalitarian approach that we're seeing with governments, really driven out of fear, and I think, I'm hoping, for public health benefit, that Big Brother really has our best interests in mind. But what comes to top of mind is this automatic assumption that the vaccine is safe and effective and is so good that we should start to change our policies with respect to work, school, travel, leisure. We should start to, in a sense, rely on vaccines to give us some additional information that we would make decisions on with respect to these important civil liberties and actually life in terms of school and work. So let me read off to you the countries that have formal proposals for vaccine passports or some form of a permission to travel according to receiving the COVID-19 vaccine, a COVID-19 vaccine. They include China, Bahrain, Georgia, Estonia, Poland, Seychelles, United Kingdom, Malaysia, Singapore, Greece, Denmark, the entire European Union, and the United States. Now, of interest, the Biden administration, while it's had favorable commenting on a vaccine passport program, has announced that the U.S. will not have a government-driven vaccine passport system. Now, the details on these passports are sketchy. It's pretty clear that the mass vaccination has databasing involved in it, and so it'd be relatively easy to figure out who received the vaccine. It would not be so easy to figure out who didn't get the vaccine and who shouldn't get the vaccine. Now, keep in mind, the CDC says if there are concerns about severe vaccine reactions, that those individuals should talk to their doctor and consider deferring on the vaccine. For the large group of COVID-recovered and suspected COVID-recovered pregnant women and childbearing potential women, there have been no inclusion of these individuals in clinical trials, so there is no scientific evidence at this point in time or no studies showing any benefit of all of COVID-19 vaccine in these groups. And with COVID-recovered patients, not only are there no evidence of any benefit of vaccinating on top of COVID-recovered patients, we have scientific evidence that the vaccine has about 2 to 3-fold increased risk of the already severe safety events. So in COVID-recovered patients, you could really be damaged with the vaccine. And that with COVID-recovered patients, we have plenty of evidence to suggest that the natural infection gives robust, complete, and durable immunity. I won't go into that more, but COVID-19 recovered patients have no opportunity for benefit and only an opportunity for harm. So none of these programs outline what we could do what we should do about individuals who can't take the vaccine or shouldn't take the vaccine. The only thing we've seen on the EU digital vaccine front is that there would be some accounting for COVID recovered patients. Let's see and hope that that emerges in the future. But very quickly, organizations have announced they're working on standards for this. The World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, the International Chamber of Commerce, the International Travel Association, and the International Health Regulatory Authorities. Others have jumped in very, very quickly. 17 companies have jumped in and said they want to help. Microsoft, IBM, MasterCard, Mayo Clinic, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and others. So there seems to be a great interest in doing this. You'd wonder, well, what would MasterCard have to do with a vaccine passport? Well, I read with interest a work by an investigative reporter, Whitney Webb, who wrote back in April a very provocative piece that said that COVID-19 or this novel coronavirus pandemic has been the opportunity that stakeholders have been waiting for a worldwide vaccine passport program that would link individuals to barcodes, to a vaccination, so we know something has been injected into the body, that individuals are databased. It could be used to control travel, commerce, and behaviors and behavior modification. It was really a chilling piece written in April, and we're seeing this evolve over time. Just in the last few weeks, the National Basketball Association has indicated that some individuals who are vaccinated could have privileges for attending, whereas those who have not been vaccinated, in fact, wouldn't. We saw at the Super Bowl, they announced that 100 vaccinated healthcare workers were permitted into the stadium, whereas there was no consideration or mention of COVID-recovered patients who can neither give nor receive the virus. And I said in several interviews, why didn't they just fill up the entire Super Bowl stadium with COVID-recovered patients, let them purchase concessions, let the TV cameras show a full stadium of happy people who are fully immune enjoying a football game without wearing masks or social distancing? Why can't we recognize that COVID-recovered patients have a great margin of safety as they move along in their lives? And I think this has been one of the difficulties in the pandemic. I think COVID-recovered patients are the most frustrated of all. They seem to get no credit for suffering through the illness. Some are hospitalized. In fact, many seniors were. People in senior homes have been subjected to repeated lockdowns and isolation, in-room isolation, and repeated nasal PCR testing, even if they're recovered, which is a restriction of their freedoms for absolutely no medical value whatsoever. COVID-recovered patients still wear masks in public and in hospitals and clinics because that's policy, as if they could give the virus or receive the virus, and they can't. So I think COVID-recovered patients really needs to step up and start to shout to the rooftops that they need rights. Being COVID recovered seems to be way better immunity than vaccine immunity, and yet the vaccinated individuals seem to be front of the line and of top interest for vaccine passports, special social privileges, work and school, etc. Well, I wanted to move into this issue of work and school and where we are with respect to really getting down to some day-to-day life feelings of being uncomfortable and threatened by the COVID-19 vaccine. Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report, and we are pushing through on this issue of passports, vaccination being used as a totalitarian weapon. And we're really getting into crunch time. What we know now is that the United States will not have a national vaccine passport program, but already discriminatory practices are coming into play. We can see them all over with respect to congregate settings, pro sports, probably college or even high school sports, work and school. Now, the states that have already seen discriminatory practices arise have drafted legislation that is either anti-discriminatory against using the COVID-19 vaccine as a method of discrimination, or banning travel passports. So those states include Arizona, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Montana, and Idaho. Who would have ever thought that the COVID-19 vaccine, which came out in December, which is under emergency use authorization, which is stated overtly that it's unknown if it's going to work, if it's safe or effective, that's not FDA approved, that has the worst safety profile of any vaccine in human history, who would ever think that the vaccine itself would become the subject of an attempt at totalitarianism? And states are trying to combat this with, in a sense, legislation that works to fight against vaccine discrimination and vaccine passports and promote civil liberties. Other states, on the other hand, have draft legislation in for vaccines to actually influence policy, and they include New York and Hawaii at this point in time. Well, I've been active. Many of you know I've testified in the U.S. Senate, the Texas Senate, the Colorado House of Commons, and most recently in the New Hampshire Senate on these issues. And I can tell you in the New Hampshire Senate, I could tell that senators were quite divided on this. Some felt like employers as well as even places of business could restrict their activities and ask about someone's vaccine status and actually make a decision about freedoms based on vaccine status. Others felt that this was a strong violation of civil liberties. There was even one senator, and she will remain unnamed, but she looked to me like a mother in her 40s. And her eyes were glazed over. I could almost see an expression of chronic fear on her face. And she said, at this point in time, she said, I don't want a single individual who's not vaccinated to get near my 7-year-old child. And I was amazed at this because children have a self-limited illness. Children themselves were not included in the mass vaccination original trials. Now there are clinical trials attempting to vaccinate children. Because children have a self-limited illness, most of the time they don't even know they have COVID-19, because there have never been any school outbreaks or a child-to-faculty transmission or vice versa, and because of the fact that we now have very good data from two large direct testing and contact tracing studies involving 10 million individuals, that asymptomatic spread accounts for less than 1% of all transmission. We know that there is no scientific rationale for children or students to undergo vaccination, none whatsoever. It can't benefit the child, and it can't benefit the family or the faculty. It's of no scientific benefit. I had a chance to give 3 minutes of my input along those points to a local school district and have school board members listen. I didn't make a single mention of the vaccine since I knew it was such a hot topic, but I did get those points across so people can understand that we don't have an underlying scientific basis to vaccinate children, or I would say I would extend that to high schoolers and college students. The college front is very hot right now. Oh my lord, we've had Notre Dame and Yale and Rutgers. They've gone gangbusters on announcing that, in fact, students would need to come back this fall and demonstrate they've been vaccinated with the COVID-19 vaccine. Again, we have no scientific basis to suggest there would be any benefit whatsoever in doing that. And we do have very good evidence that there's going to be tremendous risks, at least in some. Some will lose their lives under the vaccination mandate, and many will be injured. So this herein lies the tensions. And so as these announcements come out, and they vary, some just say completely no questions asked, there must be vaccination. Otherwise, classes have to be done virtually. Some athletes are being told, listen, they can't participate unless they are vaccinated, period. Others have come out with more reasonable announcements. I saw one from Oakland University, which is one of the commuter schools up in Michigan, where they announced that, listen, we're going to have a vaccine program, but it's going to be for the kids who live in the dorms or the university apartments, and it'll have exemptions. So it was more along the lines of the meningococcal vaccine. You know, kids go off to college, they're living in close quarters, meningococcus, which causes meningitis. It's suggested that the vaccination be undertaken. In fact, you have to fill out those forms when your kid goes to college. But keep that in mind, that the meningococcal vaccine is fully FDA approved. It's safe and effective. It does not have the risks of death and harm that the COVID-19 vaccine has. Well, let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report. We're going to finish now with what's going on with respect to mass vaccination in the universities, and is there any voice on the other side of this? And I do have to bring mention to Dr. Hooman Norchasm, who's an MD, PhD, trained at Harvard, and he's a young, I want to say youngish, in his 50s probably, cardiac surgeon who's retired from cardiac surgery after a very well-known case and settlement regarding his wife and a gynecologic procedure that was done, which was fatal in her case. And he's been left to look after his children. His children are now college age, and he's taken up the issue of mandatory vaccination. He's had a long segment on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News and has been writing open letters to the FDA and open letters to every college president who has issued a vaccine requirement for universities. So the open letter to the FDA, all of this have occurred in the last few weeks, basically said the vaccine is developing a safety track record, which is enormously concerning, that the vaccine stakeholders, which I've already mentioned, simply cannot be fair judges on safety, and that we need external doctors in review panels who are expert in reviewing deaths and safety information. That would mean doctors who have experience on a data safety monitoring board, endpoint adjudication boards of clinical trials. There's plenty of those doctors out there. I've done this dozens of times myself, so I'm very experienced on the standards by which we evaluate a case and try to determine causality, that we need an immediate safety review. And then we need what's called risk mitigation. That means do something different in the mass vaccination program to make it safer. Maybe restrict it to certain age groups or other demographic groups. Have the vaccine manufacturer start to test different doses. I've always wondered if the vaccine dose is just too strong. These reactogenic deaths that occur, it looks just like dying of COVID-19, imply that maybe the vaccine itself is too strong. We know the antibody response that you get from the vaccine is way stronger and bigger than the natural infection, but that trails off over several months. Now, the T-cell immunity, which really matters, is much less. Of course, the vaccine just is giving immunization against the spike protein, the original Wuhan spike protein, which is now basically gone from the United States. Whereas the natural infection is what you'd get with one of 14 strains in the United States, and it's against the entire virus, the spike protein, the nucleocapsid enzymes, etc. So natural immunity, biologically and clinically robust, durable, complete, permanent, vaccine immunity, none of that. So what the universities are doing, as well as employers, is they're going to look carefully at the law. And can they really require this, and what exemptions would occur? So I've been questioned by so many, Dr. McCullough, I'm feeling so uncomfortable. The vaccine doesn't look safe, but my employer or my kid's college is mandating the vaccine, and I honestly don't want to put my life on the line or sacrifice my kids for an unproven emergency use authorization vaccine. You can't blame them. It's a pretty reasonable statement. So what we have is we have the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which already has a lot of dialogue on vaccination. And the EEOC does state through a lot of different means that an employer could inquire regarding vaccination status. They could inquire regarding COVID-19 symptoms, COVID-19 status. They could do this. They have to make accommodations. The EEOC does refer to 29 CFR 1630, you can look this up, which gives an employer a right to deal with what's called an imminent threat. So if an acutely ill COVID-19 patient shows up to work, depending on the nature of the situation, the duration of symptoms, the likelihood of harm, and the imminence, those four criteria, the employer can make a decision and include remove the person from the workplace, have them work from home, have them serve out a quarantine. That's for an acutely ill patient, and it would apply to COVID-19. It could apply to someone who's, you know, acutely infectious with tuberculosis. The question is, can 29 CFR be applied to someone who's perfectly well, asymptomatic, and has just declined on taking the vaccine? Let's say they just say, listen, I don't want to take it. It's a voluntary program. I have decided not to take it. Can 29 CFR be enforced against an asymptomatic person? That's going to come up for discussion. There's already a widely known case that's been taken up by the famous attorney, Anna Garner, out of New Mexico. And it involves a EMT or a paramedic who is being forced into vaccination by his employer, and he doesn't want to take the vaccine. And these issues, EEOC 29 CFR 1630, are going to come into light in court, and there's already filings on this. Keep in mind, we've always had Title VII, which states that we can decline a medical procedure or a medical intervention based on closely held religious preferences. We can use Title VII to wear a hair covering, like a hijab, for instance, in a public space. We can use Title VII for mandatory prayer or exceptions for, and you see this for Orthodox Jews and others. So Title VII can be used for tightly held religious beliefs. And in fact, one could apply religious beliefs to a mass vaccination program and what's occurring in the world. It almost, in many ways, looks like a biblical plague, that we're in the middle of the biblical plague right now, whether we realize it or not. The other exemption that can be pulled is called the Americans with Disabilities Act. That is, there must be accommodation for those who are disabled. Now, how could a disability apply to a vaccine? Well, you could say that, listen, patients who have vaccine reactions or concerns for vaccine reactions, and now that would include all the COVID-recovered individuals where there's no opportunity for benefit and only an opportunity for harm, that in fact the ADA could be called into place. Say, listen, I have a disability. I am disabled from my ability to take the vaccine because of vaccine reaction concerns. So I think both of those will come into play. I hope things settle down very quickly. What I predict is, I predict we'll have more and more reports of vaccine breakthroughs, and it'll become more and more apparent that the vaccine is only partially effective or minimally effective. And how in the world could we have a vaccine passport program where people are getting sick on their, together with COVID-19, on their vaccine passport protected flights or basketball games, etc.? It almost seems nonsensical to have people show their vaccine passport and turn around and get COVID. It'd be better off keeping track on who had COVID, because it's such a better immunity. It's durable and complete and much more meaningful than getting the vaccine. The other issue that's going to come up is vaccine boosters. Now, the CEOs of Pfizer and Moderna have both indicated that we're probably going to get into vaccine boosters in the fall. Some have said permanent and recurrent vaccination is interesting. I can tell you, as an Anglo-American, both of these CEOs have these looks. They almost look like a characters out of James Bond movies, with these sophisticated kind of Euro Middle Eastern accents. And oh my Lord, these guys look like they could be on the other side of James Bond or Mission Impossible. And it's almost diabolical as they seem to salivate over the opportunity to continually vaccinate individuals for COVID-19. It almost seems like a zero-sum game. And I hope it we break out of it with the understanding the vaccines basically are partially effective. They're going to turn out to be probably something like the flu vaccine. It's going to be, you know, somewhat helpful if you want to take it, but if you don't take it, you don't have to. The other thing that could happen, that could be an end game here, is that people have said that the FDA, the CDC, the other vaccine stakeholders, no matter how tight this trusted news initiative is, the TNI is actively suppressing any fair balance of information get out to people on safety. So you will never see these deaths up on a scoreboard with CNN showing the number of vaccine deaths. But some have said the vaccine deaths may start to approach the number of COVID deaths. And we're going to ask ourselves, what in the world are we doing here? But one thing that could bring this to light is to have a famous superstar die with the vaccine. Well, we've already had Larry King, Marvin Hagler. We've had DMZ, the rapper. We've had one of the parliament members of Trinidad. But we haven't had anybody come into full form and have the family shout from the rooftops that, in fact, their family member was killed by the vaccine. So if I hate to say it, but if it was Oprah Winfrey or Tom Brady or someone in a perfect state of health and they immediately die with the vaccine, that may bring it to the point, which many times in America, that's what happens. There has to be some case that brings it into light to everyone to see that the vaccine itself directly causes death. And that may ultimately work to pause or shut down the program or modify it in some way where we can remove this threat of death. But I think every American who is contemplating undergoing a vaccination would have to consider the very real possibility of a vaccine-induced death and whether or not this potentially could happen in themselves or their loved ones. I think it's a very important consideration to have. So in closing, there's already some reasonableness developing across the United States. We're seeing slowing of vaccination now occurring. Ventura County, California, Crane's Detroit Business Report, all of Michigan is slowing down. In reports out of Iowa, Ohio, the Washington Post has reported the overall U.S. is slowing down with respect to mass vaccination. I think that's a good sign because that means Americans now are interpreting the data, potentially listening to the McCullough report, other sources of information, and they're making their decisions more wisely. We're at 86 million individuals fully vaccinated. If they're the right 86 million individuals, that's 26%, we could be closing out this pandemic. Keep in mind, 15% of individuals simply can't get the virus. We have the COVID recovered and the suspected COVID recovered. That's well over 200 million right there. We have children, pregnant, childbearing potential, all of which would have no significant risks of serious infection. And it's treatable anyway if we get COVID-19. So we really, in my view, were targeting or should have been targeting that narrow band of individuals, let's say age 60 to 75 with high contact jobs. We absolutely positively had to cover the nursing home workers and we had to be, I think, careful. I'm worried about vaccinating nursing home residents who are too frail and they simply can't tolerate the vaccine. So that one's a bit dicier. But clearly, nursing home workers gave COVID-19 to the nursing home patients. They had to be covered. If we've covered the right people, the pandemic could start to close out. I testified in the Texas Senate on March 10th that we are 80% herd immunity with no vaccine effect. So if the vaccine does anything at all, and let's hope it does, and can give just a percentage or point or two more of herd immunity, then the virus is not going to spread too far, and we're not going to develop one of those horrific curves that we're seeing right now in India. Well, I'll let that be the last word. Thank you so much for joining the McCullough Report. Please tune in next week, and we'll tackle the next chapter, if you will, in the COVID-19 pandemic, where we are with mass vaccination, treatments, and others. And then after that show, I'm going to start to bring in some worldwide experts, and you can hear some voices other than mine on both sides of the issue, so you can better be guided in your personal health care, and in particular, how you navigate the SARS-CoV-2 virus and the COVID-19 pandemic. That's it for this week. Again, thanks for joining.